Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. South Sudan will cut the number of staff at its embassies across the world to save costs, according to its foreign affairs ministry Tuesday. It comes as conflict and low oil prices take a toll on government finances. The nation plunged into civil war in late 2013 when a political crisis provoked fighting between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and rebels allied with the former deputy Riek Machar. South Sudan's economy has taken a beating since then, and its currency has weakened, inflation has spiraled, and revenues from oil dropped due to falling production and falling world prices. A Brussels police official says that three police officers have been slightly injured when shots were fired during an anti-terror raid in the Belgian capital. The police official, who requested anonymity because the operation was still ongoing, said the exact circumstances of the incident were still unclear, or whether the police officers were struck by bullets or injured in another way. Media reported that the anti-terror raid took place in the Forest neighborhood, which is close to Molenbeek, home to several people involved in the November 13th attacks on Paris that killed 130 people. The first wave of Russian warplanes arrived home Tuesday from Syria after President Vladimir Putin's surprise announcement to withdraw most of his forces from the Middle Eastern country after a 5.5-month operation. Russian television showed fighter planes landing at an airbase in the southern part of the country, with the pilots mobbed by supporters on their arrival and thrown into the air in celebration. Amid waving flags, they sang the Russian national anthem. This is VOA News. Police in Berlin say a man has been killed after his car exploded while he was driving. City police spokesman Michael Merkel told the Reuters news agency the explosion occurred early Tuesday. He says, what we know so far is that a driver was on his way along the Bismarckstrasse in direction of the city. The blast took place apparently shortly after he passed Krimstrasse. The vehicle left the street to the right and drove into a parked car, then came back onto the street where it stopped. The driver, which was in the car, was so severely injured that he died on the spot. Merkel said police are still at the site investigating what caused the explosion. He said homicide investigators are still at the scene. The U.S. further eased its restrictions Tuesday on American travel to Cuba and at the same time expanded Cubans' access to U.S. financial institutions and their ability to work in the United States. The new rules come just days ahead of President Barack Obama's scheduled trip to Cuba, when he will become the first U.S. sitting president to visit the island nation in nearly 90 years. A new World Health Organization, the United Nations Refugee Agency, reports that fighting between government and opposition forces in Mozambique is prompting growing numbers of refugees to flee to neighboring Malawi. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The refugee agency reports nearly 11,500 Mozambicans have fled to Malawi since mid-December. The UNHCR reports the exodus of Mozambican refugees has been growing and shows no sign of abating. Spokesman Leo Dobbs says the authorities in Malawi are finding it increasingly difficult to cope with the rising number of people. So he says the government has decided to reopen a former refugee camp to deal with the influx. He says during the past month, aid workers have seen the number of refugees arriving in Kapise grow from around 130 a day to around 250 a day. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Voters in five U.S. states are making their choices Tuesday in presidential primaries as Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton seek to further their leads. Florida is a key state in Tuesday's voting, where the Republican winner will get 99 delegates. Another state to watch is Ohio. That's where Trump is locked in a close race with State Governor John Kasich. You can read more details on this and more following the U.S. Primaries at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
War crimes, including killings, systematic rape, and forced disappearances, remain daily occurrences in South Sudan, as highlighted in reports this month from the United Nations, Amnesty International, and Human Rights Watch. Some advocacy groups say sanctions and other targeted measures could make an impact where a peace deal has failed.
That's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up.
Also, Al-Qaeda's North African branch is now threatening France and its allies following Sunday's attack on an Ivory Coast resort that left 18 people dead. And war crimes, including killings, systematic rape, and forced disappearances, remain daily occurrences in South Sudan.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Al-Qaeda's North African branch is now threatening France and its allies following Sunday's attack on an Ivory Coast resort that left 18 people dead. The French news agency reports Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb has issued a statement bragging about the attack and saying it is targeting dens of espionage and conspiracies. The statement was issued last night prior to today's visit to Ivory Coast by France's foreign and interior ministers. Four French nationals were killed in the attack. Meanwhile, Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara says he'll join both regional and international partners to fight terrorism. He says Ivory Coast will not allow itself to be intimidated. Mr. Ouattara says his country is standing up to fight the cowards and protect its people.
The UN Refugee Agency reports fighting between government and opposition forces in Mozambique is prompting growing numbers of refugees to flee to neighboring Malawi. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The Refugee Agency reports nearly 11,500 Mozambicans have fled to Malawi since mid-December. Most of the new arrivals are in the village of Kapise, about 100 kilometers south of Malawi's capital, Lilongwe. It says others are scattered throughout the neighboring district of Chikwawa. The UNHCR reports the exodus of Mozambican refugees has been growing and shows no sign of abating. Spokesman Leo Dobbs says the authorities in Malawi are finding it increasingly difficult to cope with the rising number of people. So he says the government has decided to reopen a former refugee camp to deal with the influx. He says during the past month, aid workers have seen the number of refugees arriving in Kapise grow from around 130 a day to around 250 a day.
Earlier this year, the refugees we talked to said that they were fleeing violence in their villages. More recent arrivals have said that they're fleeing for preventive reasons after fearing imminent clashes between government forces and RENAMO, the main opposition group, which has said that it wishes to take control of six provinces in the north of Mozambique.
To many observers, what is happening in Mozambique is beginning to look like a dangerous replay of its bloody civil war. That war lasted from 1977 to 1992. It killed up to 200,000 people and forcibly displaced some 2 million inside and outside the country. Many people are concerned that a new refugee crisis may be looming in southern Africa. The Luwani camp, which Malawi is reopening, previously hosted Mozambican refugees from the civil war period. It was closed in 2007. Dobbs says the UNHCR shortly will begin moving refugees from Kapise to the Luwani camp. He says the refugees will have better facilities and services available to them and that the camp will be safer than Kapise, which is only 5 kilometers from the border with Mozambique. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
War crimes, including killings, systematic rape, and forced disappearances, remain daily occurrences in South Sudan, As highlighted in reports this month from the UN, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, some advocacy groups say sanctions and other targeted measures could make an impact where a peace deal has failed. Jill Craig reports from Nairobi.
The situation in South Sudan rapidly deteriorated after fighting broke out in December 2013, resulting in serious and systematic violence against civilians, according to the UN. Amnesty International found that government forces suffocated more than 60 men and boys to death in Unity State last October, and Human Rights Watch has found evidence of grave abuses in the Western Equatoria region. Ian Schwab is the director of advocacy and impact strategy at the Enough Project, a Washington-based Africa advocacy group.
What we see is a situation where there's gross violations of human rights, looting of state coffers and natural resources, and all the while, total lack of accountability for any of these, you know, horrific crimes that are being reported.
Signatories to an August 2015 peace deal have yet to form a transitional national unity government, originally planned for November. President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar continue to disagree over the demilitarization of Juba, among other issues. Violence has continued, and the country is in the grips of a full-fledged humanitarian crisis with more than 2 million people displaced and the UN warning of famine. The Enough Project is recommending targeted sanctions.
Well, we think the best places to start are to designate higher-level officials that are involved in these crimes and to make sure that those sanctions designations are enforced. We're not talking about, you know, any sort of comprehensive sanctions that would impact the country. We're looking at particular individuals that have been complicit and have directed these types of crimes and have been looting state resources.
Human Rights Watch senior Africa researcher Jahan Henry suggests the UN impose a comprehensive arms embargo on South Sudan.
We think that an arms embargo should have been implied a long time ago. The conflict started in December of 2013, and some of the worst episodes of fighting happened in the weeks and months that followed. We think an arms embargo was appropriate back then, at the beginning, when it became so clear that this was a war being waged not between soldiers, but against civilians.
South Sudan has been free to engage in state-to-state transfers in arms, without restrictions from sellers. Ukraine, for example, has sold the government light and heavy machine guns, as well as attack helicopters. Countries such as Britain and France support the idea of an embargo. The United States has argued that an arms embargo would give rebel forces an advantage, with Russia, China, and Angola also opposed. Human Rights Watch is also calling for the African Union to fast-track plans to set up a hybrid court for South Sudan.
Sends a message that people will be held responsible for allowing these abuses or for carrying them out.
The peace deal briefly raised hopes the fighting and rights violations would come to an end. But 7 months later, many observers are questioning the deal's value. They say the time has come for the international community to take new steps to end the misery in South Sudan. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhi, 14 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Al-Qaeda North African branch is now threatening France and its allies following Sunday's attack on Ivory Coast resort that left 18 dead. And war crimes, including killing, systematic rape and forced disappearances, remain daily occurrences in South Sudan. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Burundi's foreign minister says he was not surprised at the European Union's decision this week to suspend aid to the government. In an interview with Radio France International, Alain Aime Nyamitwe downplayed the impact of the EU decision. He says Burundi can manage and has other partners who can help. However, he refused to identify them. The EU will continue to provide humanitarian assistance to Burundi. It suspended aid to the government to pressure officials to do more to seek a peaceful solution with opposition groups. The EU ambassador to Burundi, Patrick Sperley, held a news conference today in Bujumbura to talk about yesterday's suspension of direct aid to the government.
For the time being, the situation as it is now, we haven't suspended our cooperation with Burundi, but we are doing only the direct support to Burundi's population and humanitarian aid. After this, if the different benchmarks, political benchmarks, are fulfilled by the government, then we are ready to resume and to reopen progressively our cooperation with the country. The different issues of concern were the different human rights and fundamental liberties issues, the different judiciary cases, and then the political dialogue, inclusive and without any preconditions. So we receive not enough concrete measures implemented by the authorities to consider that those concerns were properly taken on board. So that's the situation we have now.
That's EU Ambassador to Burundi, Patrick Sperley. About 400 people have been killed in violence in the past year after President Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. About a quarter of a million Burundians are refugees in neighboring countries.
Macedonian authorities say they have returned hundreds of migrants and refugees to Greece after they sneaked into the country by crossing a rain-swollen river. The migrants were among those stranded at the Greek-Macedonian border at the very overcrowded camp of Idomeni. Unable to cross at Idomeni, the Associated Press says they walked 5 kilometers to an underguarded section of the Macedonian border yesterday and crossed the river. Greece's prime minister has told migrants there is no chance the Balkans route through Europe would be reopened. He urged them to relocate to new reception centers in Greece. Also, Reuters reports European Council President Donald Tusk meets today with the Turkish Prime Minister about slowing the flow of migrants and refugees to Europe. Today's meetings comes a day before EU leaders meet in Brussels. Tusk will chair that summit and is expected to present leaders with a revised deal with Turkey. Turkish officials want more concessions from the EU. The 5-year-old war in Syria is the main driver of Europe's refugee crisis. The UN Refugee Agency calls Syria the biggest humanitarian and refugee crisis of our time, causing suffering for millions of people. The head of the UNHCR, Filippo Grandi, says European countries that once welcomed Syrians are now imposing entry and border restrictions.
Nigeria's currency, the Naira, has come under intense pressure from speculators. This comes as the price of the country's main export product, crude oil, has experienced a drastic fall since last year. Nearly 200 Naira fetch $1 at the official foreign exchange window, but on the unofficial market, $1 trades for 300 Naira. In a bid to ease pressure on the Naira, the central bank has introduced a number of measures, even as President Muhammadu Buhari is resisting calls to devalue the currency. VOA's William Eagle spoke with reporter Paul Akolo in Abuja to find out why the Naira is coming under pressure and how the government is handling the problem.
The Naira is coming under pressure primarily because Nigeria's main foreign revenue earner, which is crude oil, has suffered a great amount of price slide in the past year or so, from $114 per barrel late 2014, to just around $40 per barrel today. So Nigeria has very little amount of foreign currency to play with. This is the primary reason why the Naira is coming under pressure. The second reason is also as a result of the dwindling foreign currency reserves of the country, which is also due to the low price of crude oil in the international market. Besides that, you have the taste for foreign goods, which is prevalent in Nigeria. Practically everything is imported in Nigeria, despite the fact that we are an oil-producing country. We even import gasoline for running our cars and our generators, because the refineries that are supposed to produce the gasoline are not working at full capacity. So everything is imported, and as a result of this, there is so much pressure. Everybody needs the dollar to be able to go get their products from abroad and to go and get services like medical services abroad. Some people need dollars to pay for school fees. People need dollars to go on all kinds of trips, both government officials and private businesses. Everybody travels in Nigeria, and all of this combined together are responsible for the pressure on the Naira.
What is the central bank doing to contain the pressure to devalue the Naira?
The first action the central bank has taken is to restrict sale of foreign currency, especially the dollar, to many people, many users. For instance, if you're an importer of goods and services, you cannot bring in anything as it used to be in the past, but you cannot get the dollar to bring in those goods like toothpaste, tomato paste, toothpicks, and all sorts of things that can be easily produced here. You cannot bring them in any longer using dollars sourced from the central bank. While there is no blanket ban on the importation of these goods, you cannot bring them in using dollar sourced from the central bank. So that is the first action they've taken, and a lot of importers are at a loss as to how to make ends meet these days.
You said that was the first thing they're doing. Was there another thing that the bank is doing?
The other thing the central bank is doing is to make sure that corruption is brought to the minimal level from their own end. They are trying to make sure that they don't sell dollars to broad change who make it available to people who practically have no business touching the dollar. There are lots of people who sell dollars from the street corners to broad change in offices and to all sorts of places. Thousands of broad change were opened in the country in a bid to get cheap dollar from the central bank, which they used to resell at a premium to end users. So all of these have been blocked. Fewer people are now having access to the dollar, and broad change have been asked to go source their own dollars themselves if they must remain in business. Otherwise, they are free to get out of the business so that those who can source dollars independently can remain in the business and sell dollars to genuine people who need foreign exchange for genuine business.
That was reporter Paul Okolo in Abuja. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle.
Mangrove forests are hardwood trees that grow in water between an ocean and an interior waterway. Their interlocking roots create marine life habitats and help protect human settlements from severe storm surges. But now the mangroves of Sierra Leone and Ivory Coast are threatened by rising sea levels caused by climate change, deforestation, and other factors. These threats are the focus of a study by Columbia University's Earth Institute. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed Alex DiCherbinini, one of the project's lead scientists.
Mangroves can be likened to the rainforest of the coastal zone. Mangroves sit just between the terrestrial habitats and the oceans in this sort of brackish, slightly saline, slightly freshwater environment. And what they do is they produce really dense wood, and they have root systems that cling on to the soil that are like cages almost. So they both retain the soil in the coastal zone, but they also provide really amazing fishery habitat that protects small fingerlings from being eaten by larger predatory fish. So that's what makes mangroves very unique, but also somewhat sensitive.
I understand that there's some threat to these mangroves going on, both human cause and environmental, that may ultimately be human cause, but has its roots in the climate.
Right. In the coastal zone where we're working, what you have is basically a combination of human threats. One is just the local threats, such as cutting for firewood, and then for construction material, you name it. One area of Sierra Leone that we went to as well, there was a large expansion in rice culture in the last 15 to 20 years. They will cut the mangrove as well to smoke fish. And typically, the mangroves are fairly resilient. So if it's just a small amount of firewood or a small amount of fish smoking that's going on, then they tend to rebound fairly quickly. They'll grow back. The other impact that's occurring, though, now on a global scale is climate change-induced sea level rise. Sea level rise is basically results from increased water volumes from land-based glaciers and ice sheets, and also thermal expansion of the oceans. Those two combine to create a certain level of sea level rise. It's been in the order of maybe a centimeter a decade in recent years, but that's projected to increase over this century. And one of the things that we see is that sea level rise in combination with coastal storms, say high winds and storm surge, we call it, can cause a lot of pressure on the coastal system. So one of the things that mangroves are great at are it's like a sponge or like an absorbing bumper that when that surge comes in, there's a vegetative cover on the soil that keeps the coastline from being eroded very rapidly.
What are the actual untoward consequences of this erosion degeneration of the mangrove swamps? Is it that people won't have the fish that they need to eat, or is it because it's beautiful? Or
there's two main things that you actually put your finger on, partially at least, and that is that the mangroves themselves are important fish hatcheries. So if you start cutting the mangroves extensively, you reduce the amount of fingerlings. And the fingerlings are what attract the larger fish, okay? The baby fish get eaten by the larger fish. The larger fish are what make the West African coastal fisheries so very rich. The other aspect of the mangrove loss is that some regions of coastal Sierra Leone and parts of Cote d'Ivoire are experiencing coastal erosion. So the mangroves act like bumpers or like buffers, and they put down these really deep roots. Those roots end up retaining the soil when you have storms and high winds. They can also be terrific for just protecting villages. We talked to one village that had lost roofs on multiple occasions because of high winds coming in off the ocean. But when they replanted the mangrove around the village, it actually acted like a windbreak. And so they're remarkable ecosystems that really need to be preserved.
That was Columbia University's Alex Disherbinin. He spoke to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Do you love sports? VOA Africa has more of what you love, an expanded Sunny Side of Sports show. More on-the-scene reports and analysis, plus what's trending in the sports world. Come to VOA Africa for the expanded half hour of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Remember, tune in starting Monday, March 21st, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com.
The news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Al-Qaeda's North African branch is now threatening France and its allies following Sunday's attack on an Ivory Coast resort that left 18 people dead. And war crimes, including killings, systematic rape, and forced disappearances, remain daily occurrences in South Sudan. Coming up, we'll have music from Sierra Leone, and later, protecting pregnant mothers in Africa from a mosquito-borne parasite. I'm Kim Lewis with Nahia Spuhib, and we're live in Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Sporty greetings, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are tipping off with men's college basketball.
Kim, one of the most popular sporting events here in the United States, the National Collegiate Athletic Association Men's Division I Basketball Tournament officially tips off later Tuesday night in Dayton, Ohio. Dayton is the venue for the first four stage, the first four games featuring lower-seeded teams playing for the right to enter the main round of 64 competition. The single elimination tournament will culminate April 4th when the national championship game is played in Houston, Texas. Because of the upsets in the tournament, especially in the early rounds, the competition has been nicknamed March Madness. In the first game tonight in Dayton, Florida Gulf Coast will face Fairleigh Dickinson University from New Jersey, and that will be followed by another game between Vanderbilt University, located in Nashville, Tennessee, and Wichita State University, located in Wichita, Kansas. I'm pretty sure Nigerian center Festus Ezeli of the reigning NBA champion Golden State Warriors will be rooting for Vanderbilt in that second game Tuesday night. Festus played for Vanderbilt before being drafted by the Warriors in the 2012 NBA draft. The top-seeded teams in the NCAA championship tournament are Kansas, North Carolina, Virginia, and Oregon. If you tuned into Monday's Sunny Side of Sports, you heard VOA social media reporter Andrew Palcheski mention how the Jayhawks of Kansas, a three-time national champion, include a Malian player on their roster, freshman forward Sheck Jalo.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
I mentioned the Golden State Warriors. They won their 60th game of the season Monday night when they beat the visiting New Orleans Pelicans 125-107 in Oakland, California. Star guard Stephen Curry celebrated his 28th birthday by scoring 27 points, grabbing 5 rebounds, and passing for 5 assists. Curry has been sensational this season for the Warriors, who with a mark of 60 wins and 6 losses are on pace to possibly break the record of 72 regular season wins set by the Chicago Bulls in the 1995-96 NBA season. In Monday night's other NBA results, the Dallas Mavericks topped the host Charlotte Hornets 107-96. The Miami Heat beat the visiting Denver Nuggets 124-119. The Chicago Bulls edged the host Toronto Raptors 109-107. My beloved Washington Wizards, who have been less than magical this season, scored their biggest win of the season, trouncing the Detroit Pistons by 43 points, 124-81. The Houston Rockets also turned in an explosive performance, routing the Memphis Grizzlies 130-81. The Oklahoma City Thunder stormed past the visiting Portland Trailblazers 128-94. Star guard Russell Westbrook had 17 points, 16 assists, and 10 rebounds for the Thunder. It was the 12th time this season Westbrook has recorded a triple-double, double figures in three different statistical categories. In two other results, the Phoenix Suns beat the Minnesota Timberwolves 107-104, and the Utah Jazz topped LeBron James and the visiting Cleveland Cavaliers 94-85.
Sports? Hear about it first, right here on the Sunny Side of Sports.
And this VOA programming note, beginning March 21st, the Sunny Side of Sports will expand to 30 minutes daily, Monday through Friday. So be sure to tune in at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for the newly expanded 30-minute Sunny Side of Sports, beginning March 21st. Turning to tennis, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic. Even if you're not a tennis fan, chances are you've been hearing these three names quite often for more than a decade, and especially when it's time to play for the trophy at big tournaments around the globe. They're all double-digit Grand Slam winners and still firmly on top of world tennis. VOA's Bracha Georgievich recently sat down at a suburban Washington tennis center with former professional player and now ESPN analyst Patrick McEnroe to talk about the so-called Big Three.
Former U.S. Davis Cup team captain and former pro Patrick McEnroe believes that we have been living in the golden era of men's tennis. He says Switzerland's Roger Federer, Spain's Rafael Nadal, and Serbia's Novak Djokovic are three of the greatest players of all time.
Federer, to me, is still the best I've ever seen. Djokovic certainly is on his way to maybe being in that conversation where he's right there with Federer if he can continue to do what he's done over the next 2-3 years. Obviously, Nadal, you know, maybe the greatest competitor we've ever seen, and sort of willed himself to become more than just a clay court player. And imagine if you're Andy Murray. I mean, you're a great player. You've been in multiple Grand Slam finals, only to lose to Djokovic, you know, in Australia 1,500 times. You know, he's won two majors, he won the Olympics, and he's sort of the next guy.
Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic have been so dominant that at least one of them has been in all but one Grand Slam final since the 2005 French Open. The only American to reach a Grand Slam title match in that period was Andy Roddick, losing to Federer at Wimbledon in 2009.
Most countries would have to say the same thing. If you're, you know, from Sweden, for example, from France, you know, Australia, countries that have a great history in tennis, it's pretty much been, for the most part, three players. Obviously, Murray's won a couple. Wawrinka's now won two. You know, Del Potro won the U.S. Open before he got injured. We hope he can come back and be a factor again. But you've just got these players that are so good, and the surfaces have become more similar over the years. So that means that the best players are really the best players on every surface.
And that certainly was the case in 2015, when world number one Djokovic came one match short of winning a calendar Grand Slam, all four majors in 1 year. He lost in the final in Paris to Switzerland's Stanislas Wawrinka, and Roland Garros is still the only Grand Slam the Serbian star has not won.
If he plays his absolute best, it would be hard to pick against him. But I think the gap between him and the field is not as great as it is at the other Grand Slams.
McEnroe thinks that the biggest threat for the Big Three, or Big Four if you count Murray, is going to come from players who are now 18, 19, or 20. As far as others in the top 10, he does not see them as multiple Grand Slam winners.
They might sneak in like Cilic did, like Del Potro did, and win one, but I think probably it'll come from either a Kyrgios, a Borna Korčoric, Zverev from Germany, maybe one of the American guys, Taylor Fritz, Tiafo. I think we've got a good group of young American guys as well. So I think that's probably where the next great couple of players, maybe one, maybe two players, will come from and start to dominate the majors.
However, McEnroe concludes that is still probably 2 to 3 years away. Bratsa Georgievich, VOA News, College Park, Maryland.
The voice of America, VOA.
Hello, Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoja here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brilafm.net. I tell you this. It's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on The Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Joining us once again on The Voice of America is the VOA social media reporter, Andrew Palcheski. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Good to be with you.
Andrew, what's trending in the sports world on this Tuesday?
Well, we just heard Patrick McEnroe talking about kind of the big three in tennis right now, maybe big four between Federer, Nadal, Andy Murray and Novak Djokovic. And Andy Murray is actually trending today on social media. He unfortunately lost at the BNP Paribas Open, also known as Indian Wells, out in California. Lost okay. very early in that tournament. He was expected to do quite well. And a lot of people talking about, too, there was 20 years ago in his hometown in Scotland, a massacre, a shooting at a school. And so he paid a very nice tribute on that anniversary of that massacre. So a lot of people talking about that on social media. And then Roger Federer, also a big topic because he has introduced a T-shirt that Nike is producing that has his face on it, but it's an emoji. So you have a Roger Federer emoji now, befitting of that champion that, you know, arguably greatest of all
time. I did see that emoji, Andrew, and it's definitely got his sort of his tousled hair.
Yeah, it's got the hair, it's got the headband, it's got, I think, the Nike slogan, which is just do it. It's got the whole, you know, package for him, so it's pretty cool. I want to know where I can go buy one because I'm a big Federer fan, so I'd like that.
Andrew, I encourage our Voice of America listeners to follow the sunny side of sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Andrew, what else is trending in the sports world?
Well, Steph Curry, it seems like for one reason or another, he's always trending because of his play on the court. His daughter, who's gone viral in the past because she's at the press conferences, his little, you know, 3-year-old daughter has been kind of singing and stole the show. But,
right.
He's trending today because yesterday was his 28th birthday. So very happy birthday to Steph Curry. And also the Golden State Warriors at 60 wins, 6 losses.
Incredible season.
An incredible record for them. Incredible season for Steph Curry and his team. So a lot of well wishes for him on social media. He shared a picture of a cake that the team had given him. It was decked out in the blue and gold of Golden State.
Okay.
And also had a logo for Davidson, which is the college that he went to. And people also noting, of course, Steph Curry's birthday is in March, because that was really where he got his start during March Madness when he played for Davidson
okay.
in 2008.
And how did Davidson do when Curry was on the team?
Well, they were what they call a Cinderella story. They were a 10 seed out of 16, so not expected to go very far, and they ended up going to the Elite Eight. They were one of the last 8 teams in, and on the way beat Gonzaga, which was a 7 seed, Georgetown, which was a 2 seed, and Wisconsin, which was a 3. And they ended up losing in the Elite Eight to eventual champion Kansas only by 2 points. So they nearly went to the Final Four, nearly knocked off Kansas, who went on to win the NCAA championship in 2008. But Steph Curry on social media recently talked to the NCAA about that record run and gave kind of an oral history of that. So a lot of people sharing that. A lot of people also being very kind of funny and saying, I pick Steph Curry to win my NCAA bracket. So it's unfortunately you can't pick Steph Curry to win, even though he's had great success in the NCAA tournament in the past with his school, Davidson, even though he's doing great now in the NBA with the Golden State Warriors, well recognized on social media to the point where people are saying, I'm just picking Steph to take the whole thing.
Now, Andrew, I think you mentioned it on Monday's show that you're picking the Jayhawks of Kansas to win their fourth national championship.
Picking the Jayhawks. They're the overall number one. I think they've got a good shot the way they're playing. But the interesting thing about this year is that at just about every week or every other week, the number one team in the country would lose and get upset. So they said there's about 15 or 20 teams who can conceivably win the championship this year. You have, you know, Duke and Kentucky are four seeds. So that means they're 15 or so teams ahead of them that any of those could win, including Duke and Kentucky.
Yeah, I agree. The field seems wide open this year. No undefeated, unbeaten teams.
I think the lowest number of losses is, I think, Kansas has about 30-some-odd wins, 31 wins and three losses or so, 30 wins and three losses. So it's almost like Golden State numbers there. It's, you know, 60 wins and six losses.
So as this tournament tips off, Andrew, I guess we'll see more than a few upsets in the early rounds.
Yeah, and that's, you know, social media between the announcement on Sunday of the bracket and the play-in games, which are happening coming up, is all the speculation. Who do I pick for the upset? Who do we want to win? So a lot of excitement on social media and questions about, okay, who are you picking? Or who should I pick for an upset? So it's all really a guessing game, but we'll see.
Andrew Palcheski, VOA social media reporter. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Sonny.
And we'll see you on Wednesday. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yehias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, protecting pregnant mothers from mosquito-borne parasites in Africa. But first, some music. It is Tetti of Sierra Leone with Wave Green, White, Blue.
Sierra Leone! Wave Green, White, Blue. Not for me and you.
Ain't got a boxer.
Yo, what you got here, man?
It's a collaboration thing, you know?
All right, you go first.
It's green, white, blizzard. What you know about that? On a beat, T-E-double-T-F. It's a celebration. It's straight for a better nation. Mind elevation. Now, Grasil and Menny. Now, P.O. I go school. You say we come to no go better. You know no fuck. We got diamonds and minerals. No one for like we better. I they plan on our funerals. So, better about your seats while we celebrate the feeling. And beyond aid and block down the oranges in your song. Superior administrate your flag of I. Yours truly, box of the guy.
Sierra Leone people raising the curtains, free like the Masons are talking, raising discussions. First we erasing extortion, strengthening the youth, start saving the orphans. Slavery's gone and it's placed in a coffin. We out of those cages, space and I'm bluffing. We flow through the city and I'm placed in a portion. Freetown proud, we created, we blossom. We brave with a custom. We trying to grade our ways by portraying all amazing destruction. It pays how we stayed with a braver instruction. 225 celebrating with caution.
And they sing a lovely song. From the countries alone, no matter how sad you day, ain't not for rap, sweet salon. If I could build a nation, yeah, I go build a sweet salon. If I could be a president, I go be a
everybody put your hands up in the air if you love salon.
Free tongue,
everybody put your hands up in the air if you love salon.
My fellow citizens,
jump, wave your flag up.
Even though we're poor, we know we're not gets. We still dead dressed from morning to night. We know they fix, we know they perfect. But on the long way, we not go forget. Hey, for the green agriculture, for the white peace and honor, for the blue, for the ocean. Now you flag, we all desire. So we love you. So we love you. So we love you. So we love you. So we love you.
Green, white, and blue. Oh, we love you.
Green, white, and blue flowing through my veins daily. You can tell.
finest. So place you wind it, uplines behind it.
Put your hands up in the air, you know, salo. Everybody put your hands up in the air, you know, salo.
My fellow citizen,
jump, wave your flag up. Hey. Jump, jump, wave your flag up.
Hey.
Put your hands up in the air, you know, salo.
Come, come, come.
Sierra Leone with Wave Green, White, Blue.
Well, in the malaria endemic countries of Africa, it's not uncommon for pregnant women to become infected with the mosquito-borne parasite. The disease puts newborns at risk of death, but a new prevention strategy offers hope that expectant mothers will be able to deliver healthy babies. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The risk of pregnant women becoming infected with malaria is very high in developing African countries. Researchers say 60% of women who showed up to be recruited for a prevention study had evidence of the parasite. Malaria is responsible for more than 100,000 newborns' death in sub-Saharan Africa each year. The disease can also cause infants to be born prematurely or at low birth weight, both of which are risk factors for newborn mortality. So pregnant women in malaria endemic regions are urged to sleep under insecticide-treated bed nets. Many also receive the inexpensive drug combination sulvadoxime pyrimethamine, recommended by the World Health Organization to protect against malaria. That was once the standard treatment for the disease, but the malaria parasite has become largely resistant to those drugs, according to Grant Dorsey, an infectious diseases specialist at the University of California, San Francisco.
We abandoned it, over a decade ago for treatment because of resistance. However, we're still using it to prevent malaria in pregnant women. So that was the kind of rationale behind our study, was that we felt that that this drug currently being recommended to prevent malaria in pregnancy may not be working.
So researchers have been experimenting with an artemisinin-based therapy called dihydroartemisinin piperaquine. In a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, Dorsey and colleagues report that treatment with the drug combination dramatically reduced the risk of malaria in a group of 300 Ugandan women, none of whom was infected when the study began. Some women were given three doses over their pregnancy, others received it monthly. A third group got the standard treatment.
The risk of being infected with malaria during pregnancy was reduced to 17%. And then if we gave the drug once a month, it was 5%. So just the risk of having malaria parasites at any time during pregnancy went from 40% to 17% down to 5%. And then for just having symptomatic malaria during pregnancy, the women in the standard of care arm got malaria, on average one episode per year, per person year. And that was 0.3 if you got replaced the SP with the ACT drug.
In other words, there was a dramatic reduction of malaria infection in the women who got the artemisinin-based drug compared to those who received the standard care drug treatment. Dorsey finds the results encouraging.
I think that this is a very exciting area, and if things play out as it looks, that this could lead to a change in policy and then could really improve outcomes for women.
But there are drawbacks, according to Dorsey, who says the artemisinin drug combination is more expensive and must be given more frequently than the usual preventive medicine. The World Health Organization has requested larger studies looking at the effectiveness of dihydroartemisinin piperaquine before recommending it to prevent malaria in pregnant women. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The illegal trafficking of endangered wildlife has escalated to alarming levels. In 2015, poachers killed 1,175 rhinos just in South Africa, compared to 13 in 2007. Annually, around 30,000 elephants were killed for their ivory tusks to make a profit. As a result of poaching and trafficking, many iconic endangered species are on the verge of extinction. But there is much more at stake here, said Assistant Secretary for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs William Brownfield. These crimes are not committed by small-time poachers, but by well-equipped, well-organized global criminal networks, and they are aided by a web of corrupt and criminal facilitators. These are organized, efficient, often violent, and well-funded networks. They are responsible for fueling not only the depletion of natural resources, but also undermining the rule of law, causing permanent harm to communities, local economies, and to the environment, fomenting instability, and providing a significant source of funds used by violent cartels, gangs, and even terrorists. In response to this escalation, in 2013, President Barack Obama established the Presidential Task Force on Wildlife Trafficking, co-chaired by the Departments of State, Interior, and Justice, to coordinate a whole-of-government approach to stop illegal activities that threaten the future survival of many species of wildlife. This and other efforts by the United States and its partners around the globe have caused a turning point in the fight against wildlife trafficking. For example, the State Department has partnered with the NGO African Wildlife Foundation to build regional law enforcement cooperation in Eastern Africa, develop a canine program in key ports in Africa, and elevate the issue of illegal online trade of wildlife. Implementation is underway. Through this partnership with AWF on a canine detection program, two dogs at Jomo Kenyatta International Airport have been deployed for routine baggage checks. It is evident that passengers are aware of their presence, and that in itself sends a very strong message to traffickers. Just in January 2016, four seizures were made at this airport. The entire world has a stake in protecting the world's iconic animals, said President Barack Obama, and the United States is strongly committed to meeting its obligation to help preserve the Earth's natural beauty for future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We will discuss the World Bank Conference on Land and Poverty. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa, Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.